Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another session. today's key term is Nandi Bhava. That's, can you still see? Nandi Bhava. That's N-A-N-D-I. It's pronounced longer. Nandi. In fact, it's one word, but however, I just written it as two different words. Nandi, and then B-B-H-A-V-A, Bhava. Nandi Bhava. This is a compound, actually. Compound. Grammatically speaking, this is a compound. Nandi Bhava. N-A-N-D-I, pronounced longer. So, Nandi, with the diacritic mark. So, Nandi, and B-H-A-V-A, Bhava. Nandi Bhava. Now, today's topic is, this is today's topic, meaning Nandi Bhava means delight in existence, delight in existence, delight in living. Now that's the key term. That's the topic itself today, Nandi Bhava, delight in existence. And there are two more words. There are but only four words, actually, or throughout the Tripitaka about Nandi. So we got only three of them. And next word is, well, Nandi Bhava is the key word. There are two more extra words. Next one is Nandi. Nandi or Nandi is the same word. Pronounced longer or regular. Nandi, N-A-N-D-I. Then R-A-G-A, Raga. This is also a compound. However, in English we write, when we romanize it for easier pronunciation and memory, memorization, we simply write it as two words. Otherwise, this is a compound. Nandi, Raga. R-A-G-A. Raga is attachment. Affection, attachment. Nandi. Meaning, delight is the only thing that you always look for. That's what it implies. Delight is nothing but delight. Just like you say truth, but nothing but the truth. So, Nandi Raga. Raga is, as you know, attachment. That also implies sensuality, sexuality, running after. So, that's the second word, Nandi Raga. And there's another phrase that comes wherever Nandi Bhava is. That's N-A-N-D-I, long I, Nandi, dash, B-H-A-V-A, Bhava, and Parikhina, P-A-R-I-K-K-H-I, long I, so pronounced longer, N-A, Parikhina. Now, as you know, Nandi Bhava means delight in existence. Nandi Bhava Parikhina. Parikhina means completely destroyed. Delight in existence completely destroyed. Parikhina. Now this is the key term. That is where we're going to the discussion here. Now, we all look for, given the opportunity, we take delight in anything that comes across our senses. In fact, that is the Buddhist definition of living life. If you are the purpose of life, philosophically, there's no single purpose of life. Purpose depends on the moment, because it is the moment that brings us happiness or sadness. However, based on this term, if you want a lifelong purpose, I mean the one single universal purpose of life, that is delight. We are seekers after delight. Now, as Bodhisattva was, as Siddhartha was well known, he was a seeker, but he was not a seeker after delight. He was a seeker after truth. Two different wordings. Now, enlightened people, this is what enlightened people always try to achieve. Nandi Bhava Parikhina. Now, that's where the problem is. First question could be from Lux. Right.
So it's delight in existence.
Yeah, so this now, that enlightened people, or I mean, that someone, like someone who aspires to be the Buddha, Samma Sambuddha, or a Paccheka Buddha, or an Arahat, would sacrifice, dedicate all their life to achieving Nirvana, means that they want to end parikina. Pari means completely in its entirety. Kina means to extirpate, delete, to completely let go of what? Let go of what? Let go of delight in existence. Now, it depends on the individuals, I must say. And Buddha appreciates beauty and aesthetics. And Buddha appreciates physical beauty, and he goes to the extent and to say that karma can bring you beauty and things also. So beauty is highly appreciated in the Dhamma. Now, so Nandi, but however, it is up to individuals to decide whether to keep looking for delight in during their existence or to stop and walk away from that circle. So you have a choice. See, Buddha has never used like wordings of commandments, like should, must, except in the case of monastics, because this is our chosen life. So we had to abide by, we had to live a different kind of life. Otherwise, for the general public, for the people, Buddha would simply say, even when he gives a warning sign, he would simply say, you may not do that. You may not do that. He would never say, you shouldn't do that. Nowhere has the Buddha says, you shouldn't kill. He doesn't have to say that. He would simply say, you wouldn't kill. You may not kill. If you do, it's your choice. It's always what is upheld in Buddhist spirituality is free will. Free will. Free will, there's a Pali word for free will too, but you don't need too many Pali words. Free will. If you ask what Buddha's teaching is based on, you could say it's based on an individual's free will. However, it's up to you to avoid adversities. It is your duty. You have to take care of yourself. If there is a must or should kind of warning that he has given, that is when he defines the difference between good and evil. If you, for the sake of delight in life, so for the sake of enjoyment in life, you may not cause any harm to yourself or to anyone else. If you put someone else in trouble for the sake of your own happiness, it is unethical. If you do things to make others happy but putting yourself at risk, that is also unethical. If you put both parties at risk, it is unethical. You put neither party in trouble, it is ethical. So that is the criteria. And that's also, he simply says may not, would not. So then Nandi Bhava, this is a key term that also occurs in the Buddha's first sermon, Dhamma Chakkappavattana Sutta. There he says, Tatra Tatra Abhinandini. Do you want me to get it on the board or you don't need it? I will just explain it. Tatra tatra, wherever. Abhinandini. Mind gets, Nandana is delight. Abhi means deep delight. Always Abhi means profound or deep. Tatra tatra abhinandini. He explains in his teachings based on his own experience. During his bodhisattva life for many, many eons, many, many past lives, he explained that how he got engulfed in fear, insecurity, and all this due to wavering mindset. Sometimes he never wanted to. He felt like whether fear is going to be there forever in his life as a bodhisattva. So based on his experience, he says that given the chance, given the opportunity, the mind would always run after something that it would like to take delight in by itself. And it would be beyond the control of the very individual to whom the mind belongs. So tatra tatra abhi nandini. And that's another phrase Buddha says. Wherever, given the chance, the mind would go wherever it would like to go and take delight in what they would like to do. And when it comes to Nandi again means delight. It's also a little different than piti or joy. Because, do you know, I didn't actually look into the dictionary because I love etymology. I didn't have time to see the difference between joy and delight. There's no way to go online because I'm recording. Joy and delight. However, to me, delight is something that when you are delightful means it's way different than happiness and joy. You go through, you can even get goosebumps when you are delighted something. It cuts through your body, your mind, your emotions, everything. You even go through some sudden biological, you feel like your body is changing as well in response to that mindset, delight. So as we continue, you can look into, someone can look into the definition of delight. And he's doing that, I guess. Hope Gami is doing that. So now, and raga, we have discussed raga a lot. Raga on different occasions. Raga is so raga has several meanings. It basically means sensuality, and it also has the connotation of sexuality. Raga specifically means sexuality as well. Raga. It's attachment. So many things. Raga is one of the 108 kinds of tanha or thirst or craving. There are 108 kinds of, 8 types of tanha. Yes, please, yeah.
mm-hmm. What is the true meaning of delight?
Mm-hmm.
A high degree of gratification
uh-huh.
or pleasure.
Or pleasure.
A high degree of gratification or pleasure. Joy.
Mm.
Children squealing in delight.
Mm.
Also, extreme satisfaction.
Extreme.
Seems to take delight in the misfortune of others.
Uh-huh. So, that's a very good example. Yeah. So thank you very much. Thank you. See, it causes some kind of
satisfaction,
yeah. And it is deep, actually. It's normal than, for example, let's say, every day I happen to eat rice and curry, right? And Chitra, you bring me Haagen-Dazs ice cream, don't bring me. So that's delight, right? When you bring me the same rice and curry and I'm hungry, so I would eat it. Okay, I'm happy that you have brought me food. At the same time, you beat me, and Banti, I have brought you something else. What is that? It's ice cream. Then I can very easily forget rice and curry, and I can grab ice cream from you before you give it to me. Okay, so that's delight, I guess. I'm delighted, and when it comes to, there's another word for delight. Nandi, one word. That's another word. Ramani. Mm. Ramani is a Sri Lankan girl's name. Ramani. There are a lot of Ramanis coming here. There was one day one Ramani came and she's very sad. I said, you are not Ramani today. What do you mean by that? Because you are not happy today. You are not delightful. Oh, that's what it means? Yes. I have to live up to my name then. So her sadness is gone. Instant counseling. So Ramani. Where Buddha talks about, where Buddha explains how arahats, Buddha and enlightened people, take delight in forests, mountains, beautiful landscape, rivers, etc. And Buddha uses the word Ramani. That's also delight. And Buddha says, there's another, so now, lay people, I mean unenlightened people, to them, what delight means to them is something else, something that is very different than what it means to enlightened people. So, and Buddha says, who truly enjoys natural landscapes and beauty and birds singing, rivers flowing and waterfalls and beautiful greeneries and all these are not all unenlightened people. Not unenlightened people, but enlightened people. Why is that? They simply see it, but they don't have raga to it. There's no raga. When the raga is involved, you conceptualize it. Always you become so that you are back to your subjective thinking. For example, let's say, so I am not enlightened. When I go to, let's say, if I visit the most beautiful landscape in the world, wherever it is, when I go there the first time, it is breathtaking. When I happen to go the second time there, I would say, no, I know a better place. I would say to my, okay, I know a better place. I don't like this place anymore. And that is because of Nandi Raga. Raga makes you, when you go a few rounds of experience and you get fed up with that, you feel like looking for something else. For which reason Buddha says in his first sermon, Tatra Tatra Vinandini, then the mind would start wandering around and then cling to something else, which would be beyond your control. And that's what Buddha explains. Now, again, it's up to you to enjoy. But why then some people get fed up with Nandiraga, delight in bhava is, again, bhava is living or existence. Bhava also means becoming. When you apply that meaning, and it makes more sense actually, delight in becoming. Becoming and re-becoming, you know, samsara. Every moment we become and re-become. Every moment we become something means we re-become. So delight, so that we give up on we are in the middle of enjoying something. Oh no, this is not what I want. I need something else. This something else after something else and something else never stops. In fact, that is also a modern day definition of samsara. The repetition of something else after something else after something else after something else. And you keep saying that. Where most Buddhists are mistaken, actually. I am always critical of my people. I always say that. So I am only comfortable discussing that with Lux and Chitra and few people, actually. I'm not praising you because you're in your presence. I'm speaking my heart. Now, most Buddhists that I have come across, they don't know how to take delight in their life. They don't know how to see beauty. They don't know how to, so that is why they live in denial. In fact, Buddha wants us to see beauty as it is. Right? See beauty as it is. Now, when you go to a higher level, if your goal is enlightenment, you can generalize it. Simply because I am working on my enlightenment means I am not supposed to force it onto you. I'm not going to ask you, Lux, okay, try for your enlightenment. I will never ask. If I do that, it would be like I am forcing ascetic Buddhism onto you. Ascetic, right? Because I'm so that remember one of the previous sessions we talked about what is that? Two words, the two extremes. Ascetic and
hedonist.
Yeah, ascetic and hedonist. Those are only extremes. If you are, if you go for that, go for ascetic practice, don't go to extremes, and you have a perfect right to be hedonistic, but don't get, don't go to the deep end. Right? You may not be able to swim back. So, and it's always the balance. Now, so there are so many. One of the words that Buddha has used to describe ways in which people can enjoy their samsara, their existence, is kalyani. Kalyani is beauty. Kalyani, think about your beautiful teeth. Dental kalyani. Chavi kalyani is the skin kalyani. Kalyani means beauty. Mansa kalyani, lean muscles. Mansa kalyani. Chavi kalyani, skin. There are, and Buddha explains that too. One should be able to enjoy their physical beauty. So that is when every time someone asked Buddha about Visakha, when somebody asked Buddha whether Visakha was a sotapanna or she, that it was a well-known fact that she became a sotapanna or achieved the first level of enlightenment when she was 7 years old. And then sometimes some people would ask the Buddha like this, well, why did she then marry and have children, and she's having grandchildren? And Buddha would separate, and he would see as two separate things. Her sotapanna or achievement or the first level of enlightenment has nothing to do with her role in helping her husband run businesses, her business, and taking care of her children and babysitting her granddaughters. So that's when one day, when it was raining, Visakha and her daughters and granddaughters were rushing. They were cutting through the temple grounds because her palace was nearby in the vicinity. And so all the monks were looking at her. And one monk opened up and said, Visakha, I can't see the difference between... I can't say who is grandma, who is granddaughter. They are that beautiful. And Buddha said, okay, they are lucky. They are meritorious. It is their good karma that they have beauty. They have marvelous beauty. Had the Buddha... believed or thought that beauty is something that you need to condemn, he wouldn't have talked about like that. So, but that's where most people get fundamentally mistaken as to the Buddhist spiritual practice. They say, well, beauty is bad. No, don't even look at that. Don't even think about it. And right away you go to denial. That is called invited dukkha. You forcefully inflict dukkha into yourself. Inflicted dukkha and natural dukkha are two different things. Inflicted dukkha. Inflicted dukkha is when you forcefully, you force to your, force yourself to see, okay, I don't like him, I don't like, I hate the world, and I should walk away from the world. So as I said, you know, repeatedly, you know, last week or the previous week, on a regular basis, like youngsters, like girls and boys, call me and say they want to be a nun or a monk. They want to become monastics. The very first question I would not really ask, but I would suggest, do you want to do that because you just broke up your boyfriend or girlfriend? How do you know? I said, that's not wisdom. You are disappointed. You are disappointed now. You think that the only girl, the only boy, that was available to you was the one that you broke up with. So now that, because you, then I would tell them the story of the monkey. Right? When the farmer gave a monkey a fistful of grains, so he dropped one grain accidentally. What the monkey did was, he got distracted by the lost grain, and he threw the rest of the grains somewhere, and then he came down, and he was up in a tree, and he started searching for the lost grain. Lost grain. Most people do that. I almost said we all. Most people do that. And actually, that is where the trap is. When you are too much into something, and you would easily disregard or devalue everything else. Yes.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
How do we appreciate beauty in a way that doesn't create something ugly? For example, if I have a garden, and perhaps there's one flower that I consider very beautiful, and then there's another that's less beautiful but grows more proficiently.
Exactly.
I might then decide I have to kill or destroy the other flower in favor of the beautiful one.
Yeah. Actually, that explains the fact that we have discussed here. But at that point, you need anuraga. Not raga, anuraga. Anuraga is romance. In romance. When I do wedding marriage counseling, I always notice that. Either party fails to, after some time, when their sexual feelings have been satisfied and they no longer appreciate their presence in their life, each other's life, and sometimes they always, they set their mind is what is called like defense mode something. There's another better English word, I forgot that. This is another beautiful word for that. So that you need to appreciate the movements. For example, let's say you have a garden, it's full of roses, and there are other weeds as well. Sometimes you can see wildflowers also, right? Now, in case you are in a situation that you find it difficult to eliminate and get rid of all these weeds, and they keep coming back, no chemical fertilizer would help you, it happens. So you would either, so even at the same time, there's no way to uproot the plants and plant them somewhere else, but it is the same soil condition and stuff. And so at that point, while you continually get rid of the weeds, at the same time, you can say like this, because I noticed that when I was in charge of a flower bed, when I was a novice monk, there were so many weed plants destroying a dahlia, all kind of flowers. And then what I did was, one day, I went to a monastery for 2 weeks. It was a vacation. So nobody wanted to touch my flowers, lest I would get angry, and then so that what happens was, when I came back, there were so many weeds everywhere. However, it was all dark green, and then dahlias were red and yellow, and they were shining among these weed plants. I saw in the green background the dahlias look more beautiful. For the moment, I made up my mind, say, okay, today I see the dahlias more beautiful this time against the green background. So the only things we can comfort ourselves, we find a way to cope with that. Sometimes when a situation is beyond our control, there's no way that we get frustrated. Instead, we cope with it, we face it. When it comes to individual people, most people, I noticed that in marriage counseling, over time, people lose, they lose raga towards each other. So as a result, they begin to find fault with each other. They derive no happiness, no gratification whatsoever from each other. And then I would always say, okay, I will ask them to go back to their, their early days of their marriage, or in case it was a love marriage, when they were dating each other, and how they would appreciate their voice, each other's voice and gestures and mannerisms and the dress and all these beauty. Even they would even find their coughing, sneezing romantic. I love the way you sneeze. I love the way you cough. That's how people do that. So then, and yes. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Bhante. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it seems like the attachment to things that an arahat might find a nice scene, but people who are not arahats engage in other delights.
Mm.
Are those other delights? Is the difference that you put yourself in it? You enjoy sex. You enjoy lovely food. Is the difference that you imagine yourself engaging? I can't see the difference.
No,
I can't really see the difference, because
there's no difference. What is different is the degree of delight.
Yeah.
That's the degree. So that is when you think that, okay, when I do this, I am happier. And so that over time you say, no, I want to do something else. When you do something else that you had done before, then you feel happier than the previous moment. So all these situations are agents of the same universal delight.
Yeah. I like putting... Yes. Experiments on arahats.
Yeah. Okay. good.
So an arahat comes along, uh-huh. sees a nice, lovely scenery.
Mm-hmm.
One day,
mm-hmm.
the next day he comes along and they've mowed it, taken it all down and made the rubbish stick.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm.
What's going on in his mind?
Yeah. The bananas. That's the banana. He wouldn't care. Because there's no relative thinking. Because what we do is we are subjective. We are subjective beings. Yesterday there are a lot of flowers and today it's all destroyed. And then why I'm sad today is because the only thing I want to see is these flowers there. Whereas the reality has changed. The situation is against my subconscious willingness to see. So, whereas in their case, they are not subjective. They see the situation only. So they wouldn't be sad. They shouldn't be sad. What happened when the Shakyans were obliterated by King Vidudava, I guess, some of them escaped. And from, it says that according to the history, it is from those few Shakyans who escape death that the Maurya dynasty started, that so the king or the emperor Ashoka. That's how the Ashoka is related to Buddha. Now, when Buddha tried to intervene several times, when he saw that the Shakyans were going to be obliterated by the King Vidudava, and he was silent. And after they were massacred, there was a huge, so that after the carnage, and then Venerable Ananda, someone asked Buddha, why didn't you save your relatives, your clan, your dynasty? And Buddha, there was no way to do that. And then his question was, whether Buddha was sad. Now, so Buddha wasn't sad at all because he's enlightened. Suppose let's say he was sad. Right? When it comes to my case, I would be saddened by the death of my friend. I'd be more saddened by the death of my parents. Because there's the degree of love and affection varies from person to person that I love. In the Buddha's case, there was no such difference. To him, there was no sadness at all. But if he was not enlightened yet, definitely he wouldn't have tried more, done everything possible to save Sakyans. So, and then when Buddha was repeatedly asked, and Buddha simply, his answer would be very short, the same universal answer. The answer would be, Ditte Ditta Mattang. When you see that something, and simply forget it by telling yourself you saw something, that's it. When you hear something, create no attachment to that. When you see something, create no attachment to it.
So the next day when he comes to the same scene, he's not expecting
exactly
to see the nice scene.
Exactly. He's not expecting.
He just sees a
dumpyard
and sees the beauty in the dumpyard.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I find myself thinking here about impermanence.
Uh-huh.
And that seems to be a helpful principle.
Principle, yes.
To deal with all these situations.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Because consciously, especially consciously, subconsciously, we maintain a sense of permanence regarding everything. Even though we know that in reality that someone is not going to be with us forever, however, subconsciously, we maintain that my friend should be there forever. So that is why we cry. We get shocked. That's why we cry. Why? Things are happening against our subconscious expectations. I like the way you use that word, expectation. So,
I just wanted to ask, how does compassion arise out of a state like that? Because if we're learning that the Buddha, as an enlightened one, wouldn't blink at a massacre.
Yeah.
And we live in a world where there are massacres, and less enlightened ones than enlightened ones.
That's right, yeah.
What can we learn from
that? You come up with two levels of compassion. There's a level A, level B. Level B is that you cry with the victims, or cry for or with the victims. Level A is you maintain mental toughness, and instantaneously you think of a way to help them out. But what happens to most people is instant they become emotional. First they become emotional, then they try to act out of their emotions to help them out. Whereas enlightened people skip that level because they don't have attachment.
So does that mean no feelings?
They have feelings to help. Because why? Now, when I am in trouble, when I am going through some problems, so that you reflect my situation upon yourself. Subconsciously, you think of your own troubles. So where it doesn't happen to enlightened people. It does happen to you. It does happen to me. So that is when instantaneously, subconscious, I think about my well-being. Somewhere lower the Sangara is one note, says, Asal geka sorakhaṁ gya davasaka. When you are next door neighbor, when there's a break into your next door neighbor's house, and then there were burglars, even when you hear about burglary somewhere in the vicinity or on the news, what you think about immediately is about your own house. Sometimes you see a news, in America, okay, this is how some thieves, they broke into a house and they even raped some people, they killed and they put the house on fire. When you hear the news, sometimes at the same moment you see you hear a sound like someone is knocking on your door, and you get shocked. Why? You reflect that upon yourself.
That's very true.
Yeah, it happens to upon yourself. So that is why, whereas it doesn't happen to enlightened people, because they are not subjective. we do subjective reflection of some we subject to reflect upon ourselves someone else's situation experience.
That's often how you imagine yourself.
Yes. Health.
If somebody says, oh,
exactly.
I'm having an argument with my wife.
That's right.
My mind will go.
Yeah.
And I'll say, this is what I did.
That's right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's why we put a lot of emphasis on I. I did that.
Yeah.
I did that. I told you, not you. That's right. Yes.
What is the? I can't remember the name of the sutta in which he says, when seeing, just see.
Mm-hmm.
When hearing, just hear.
I think Satipatthana. There are a few sutras. I'll let you know the exact sutra. You remember that sutra? Ditte dittamattam sutte sutamattam. I can pull that out later on.
Okay.
There are a few sutras.
So it doesn't mean not helping.
Yeah.
It means helping, but from an advanced point of action.
That's right, yeah. Mm. Sak, can you Google for ditte dittamattam sutte sutamattam? I like your Pali. Mm. Yes, Lux.
There has to be expectation because...
There has to be. Yeah, actually Buddha said there has to be. Nandi raga, nandi bhava, yes.
Because a group of arahats might decide to go from one town to the other, expecting
yeah.
shelter.
And Buddha says
So there are this group of monks, some are arahats, some are not arahats, expecting shelter here.
Right.
Get there,
yeah.
And the shelter's been destroyed.
Mm.
So the difference between these two peoples are...
Good analogy.
That both of them are expecting to see that.
Mm.
But in the case of the arahat, was it an expectation of delight?
The memories.
The memory of that place is there, but the memory of delighting in the place. What's the difference?
Yeah, the difference is they don't. When they see that the place has been destroyed, they would simply go some other way. Whereas unenlightened ones, and they would lament on that. Lament on that. Even if someone else comes over and say, okay, please come with me and we will find accommodation, and they would say, but we love this place. I can't imagine that this being destroyed. Whereas when it comes to arahat, they wouldn't think like that. They would simply say that they observe what is called Dhamma Sangvega. There are three words for that. Soka is there. In the case of arahants, is sangvega. Soka, sorrow, but it literally means the flickering flame of sadness in your heart. So always you are burning inside. That's called soka. Actually, sorrow is not the actual correct translation of soka, but that's the universally accepted translation. It literally means out of insecurity, you're always expecting something negative to happen.
You're always ready to
So you're always ready to encounter something negative because there's no self-confidence. Mm. You don't trust yourself and always like waiting for something negative to happen. And when it happens, and that it's not awareness, it's not wisdom. So it is a chronic samsaric fear. So that's why Buddha samsaroga mahabhaya. The worst fear is the fear of existential fear. Fear of existence, meaning something. What if something negative happens? What if something negative happens? So where a sangvega. Sangvega is you make up your mind instantaneously. You don't compare two different situations like London Buddhist, the place was there yesterday and it's been destroyed today. It's no longer here. So whereas the arahats wouldn't compare, because they we do comparisons and we think relativity is based on subjectivity, because you're subjective beings.
It's almost like the understanding of impermanence is kind of built in and automatic in the arahats. They're not
yes.
They're expecting to go there, not expect. They remember something being there.
That's right.
But not.
But it's not their world. It's not their world. Now.
Moment to moment.
But whereas, you see, in the case of ordinary people, we don't simply see or sense. The moment we see something, we create a whole totally different new world out of it. They don't do that. Arahats don't do that. So that's where the problem is, because our world is based on perception. Perception. We don't see the London Buddhist Vihara library, actually. Now, I know a lot of university students come here for reading, and they get delighted to see this huge number of books. Sometimes, in case someone comes from a university, we have a bigger collection of Buddhism books, and then they are still delighted to see the books, and they would say, okay, our collection is way bigger than this. However, I'm here to try to see whether the book that I'm looking for is available here. So there's a lesser degree of delight. So that's why always delight, it is the same. Delight, getting delighted is the same universal built-in tendency. However, based on the situation, it could be more or less. Now, when it comes to enlightened people, they are not subjective. It is said that enlightened people look at themselves objectively, like indriya and arambana. So we have indriyas, meaning sense organs, and so the sense faculties, arambana, the sense objects. So enlightened people objectify themselves. And that's when Buddha says enlightened people would look at their existence just like they observe amla fruit. Amla is an Indian word, there's no English word. It's transparent. You can see the seed in the middle, amla fruit. So that's because they are not subjective. So ordinary people find it difficult to come out of themselves. See, when you are standing like few yards away from a beautiful building, only then can you see the beauty of that building. When you are inside the building, you can see the interior, but you don't see the building, the beauty out. So that's when you become an outsider. You adopt an outsider perspective towards on your own existence. That's what enlightened people do. Outsider, always. That's called indriya arambana based perception. They have the perception, arambana based, not indriya based. Indriya based means subjective. Arambana based means objective.
Is the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking recently,
noticing
that if I have a strong desire for something, quite often that desire is so strong that both me, myself, the I that I am, and the thing that I desire is almost lost in it, if that makes sense. For example, imagine I see a beautiful person. I'm not considering in that moment if they see me as beautiful or if they have any interest that I do. And in the same way, I'm not acknowledging them as somebody with agency to make up their own mind.
Right, yeah.
All that's happening is this
exactly
sensation, is this feeling. And in that respect, There's no version of me or
no,
them
nothing.
As an object.
That's a, the only version of me is the version that I am being, I'm able to create info to impress the other party that I like. Sometimes you get your lips dry, you try to wet your lips, and you try to, you go through some emotional change, even some biological change. Sometimes you are red-faced. So that's
all,
when?
It's all senses.
All senses, yeah. That's because you are preparing, so you are in the middle of, you're in the trying to impress the party that you want in your life. So at that point, you actually, there's a totally different version of, you keep reversing, modifying your identity so that you are completely lost within yourself. When it happens to the extent, a certain extent, sometimes we would say, it takes you a moment to regain your consciousness, something. Sometimes you don't know what you said. It takes you a moment to remember what you said. And sometimes when you become apologetic, can say, did I say something? Well, nothing. Sometimes you feel like you said something, actually you didn't. So that the loss of self, it happens when your delight becomes cut through yourself. Like when Rahula was ordained, Rahula was the only source of solace to King Suddhodana when Siddhartha became the Buddha. And he got the news that Rahula had now been ordained by the Buddha. And Siddhartha, king went and then said, sir, Rahula was my only source of happiness. Now you ordain him. Do you know that the sadness of out of losing my grandchild, it cuts through my skin, it cuts through my flesh, it cuts through my veins, it cuts through my bones. And then says, okay, please hereafter, so promulgate, get a rule in place that without parental permission, a child should not be ordained, and Buddha accepted that. At that moment, Suddhodana was explaining, he was lost in his words, because the only source of delight to him was the king. A king would always think about a crown prince, right? When Siddhartha Nanda, Prince Nanda, he also got ordained later on. The only remaining hope was Rahula. So at that point, Suddhodana gave a long explanation of his feelings. And Buddha felt it, and Buddha accepted it right away. And thereafter, no child would be ordained without parents' permission, consent. And then when when Patachara, when she lost her husband and two children, and so she became lost her sanity, and so that she started running here and there, and so that fully knew, and later when she approached the Buddha, and Buddha asked, okay, sister, it's time to see yourself. It's time to see yourself. And that's when she seen myself. Okay, I'm here. So that is when she regained her consciousness. So it happened. So that is when Buddha says, it is not mandatory that you go for parikhina, for the total extirpation or total letting go of even andiraga existence, bhava. It is an option. If you only those who are fed up with their existence, having enjoyed trying to, and so they may go forth, and that's the word for ordination. Going forth versus getting stuck. That's the literal, that's the word for ordination, going forth. So the situations regarding lay people, household life, it's called getting stuck. Pabbajita. Pabbajita is go forth. I remember once one Cambodian ambassador in Canada, he asked me, Bhante, when did you go forth? Meaning, when did you become a monk? And then he told, okay, sir, and then I explained to him. And then he told me that as a layperson, I remain stuck. But once in a while, I will take a break for one week or 2 weeks, and then I will temporarily go forth, meaning temporarily ordination. So going forth and getting stuck. So you have a choice. So that is when Buddha simply explains the beauty. Now, Buddha explains samsara as it is. He never forces you to leave samsara. Because it's not fair. It's not fair. He simply explains. If he recommends that everyone leaves samsara, then his teaching is not Dhamma anymore. It becomes theoretical then. So there will be a discourse against beauty. He never had an anti-beauty discourse. There was no such thing. He simply explains as the situations, as things as they truly are. And it's up to individuals to understand. And there also Buddha gives a warning sign. Simply because you broke up with something, broke up with the world, don't go forth. Don't try to go forth. Don't try to become a monastic. You are leaving not because you have wisdom, but because you are hateful. You are hateful, you are disappointed. You feel like never reconnecting with the world. Meaning you have broken. So that is where the difference is. So that is when parikkhina. And in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutra also, Buddha simply explains how mind works. Mind would love to go wherever it would like to go and take delight in. Tatra tatra abhinandini. And that's when he says, okay, you need to be watchful of that. Not to run away from lay life yet. It's up to you. You have to do a lot of investigations. Pursuit. Any other questions?
So, are lay people, by definition, stuck? Or is there a way a lay person can go forth, so to speak, without becoming monastic?
So, you have the key to... You are not locked to yourself up in the room, and you hold the key. Nobody has the key. Nobody else has the key. So this is what is called, there's another analogy, open cage analogy. Some people are so conditioned to live in captivity, even with the cage door is open, you are not willing to fly away. You are not trying to fly away. You feel like, so you volunteer to remain stuck. Because the thing is, you don't trust anyone. You don't trust the society, you don't trust your perception, you don't trust your experience, you don't trust anything. So that's why, so that is when Buddha recommends that if someone has lived with that mentality, they really need assistance from a Kalyana Mitta, trustworthy friend. That is called, what is it, open cage door analogy something. I have seen that picture. It's one of my favorite pictures. There's a bird in sad mood in the cage. The door is open, but he's not willing to fly away. It would like to remain in captivity. So Buddha simply encourages you to see. So there are no protocols and rules and regulations when it comes to choosing lay life or life of a monk. I know a lot of monks who became monks simply because some people who broke up with their girlfriends, some girls because they broke up with their boyfriends, or they were very hate, they left their lay life hating their parents because the parents didn't let them marry their whomsoever they loved. And so to take revenge from their parents, they became monks or nuns. And over time, when they see someone else, or when they meet a look-alike, I know some bhikkhunis and bhikkhus, what happened to them. I know one bhikkhu, he only remained in the robe he's 23, he disrobed 3 days ago. 3 days ago. So that what happens was, now, it is a genetic condition too, because his family is famous in the area for sex addicts. It's a genetic condition. So he had the girlfriend when he was like 14 years old. However, he became a monk because his parents never wanted him to go with that girl. So what happens was he became disappointed and became a monk. However, over time, there was another girl coming to the temple for pujas, and that girl was her girlfriend's look-alike. And then he further conceptualized, and once he told me, her voice is different, but now I feel like it is the same kind of voice, same voice. She had the same voice. I said, that thing you have mentally added. So it's not the same voice, because I knew both girls. And he couldn't stand, he couldn't cope with that emotion, feeling in his robe days ago. And I know, because I know some people in London, Canada especially, I had a lot of research. Sometimes when I know three guys, they wanted to marry their girls. I mean, the girl that they loved. When their parents were against that, what they did was, quite subconsciously, they had found girls that are lookalikes. One day I asked one, are you happy with your new girlfriend? Yes. Why? If I see my former, right, and she would be jealous. Why? This girl is exact. This girl resembles her. This is exact look-alike. Not look-alike. It's the same one. Actually, this one is more beautiful. In case I encounter my former, the ex, what I would is I would buy this girl and then fancy clothes, and I will take her around, show her off. Now, you may think that these are something silly. No, this is not silly, actually. That's natural. Natural things. That is how we naturally respond to our need, delight in our existence, in our life. So Buddha simply appreciates that. Aesthetic value. He doesn't say anything against beauty or samsara. Why? If you adopt an ascetic approach to a lay life, what happens is you would fail to enjoy your worldly existence. What instead of understanding or wisdom, you would have achieved what is called denial. You'd end up in denial. I don't need anyone, so I have come up with some people, so some even two young men, one 19, one 21. I met them a couple of years ago when I went to Sri Lanka. I met them in the mental hospital. They wanted to get enlightened to teach their girlfriends a lesson. So they wanted to go beyond the world to show their girlfriend, I mean their exes, right? I don't know, in plural, to that they are now enlightened. But actually they ended up in mental hospital. So that is when Buddha said, don't force yourself to become enlightened. A monk is saying this. If I do that, then I'm forcing an ascetic approach to you. See, I myself find it difficult because I have to slow down. I at times have to slow down. right? Because I'm living, I'm part of this samsara. Right?
So how about doing meditation?
Then? Yeah.
Meditation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You do the Vedananupassana. Vedananupassana is the best. Meditation on sensations or feelings, one of the four satipatthanas, four foundations of mindfulness. So the Vedana-based foundation is way more pragmatic and more helpful to me on a daily basis. Because Chittanupassana is the mind, Dhammanupassana the nature. You experience perceptions. Kayanupassana, I'm very subject when it comes to my body. Right? When I am aging, I would try to pretend, I would get into a game of pretense and try to convince myself, no, I am not okay, Upanandhi, you are not old. When someone says to me, you are younger, Bhante, how really? What did you say? Right? I sometimes won't reconfirm. So that Vedananupassana, in my case, Vedananupassana is the easier one for me when I practice Vedananupassana. When I dissolve certain sensations or Vedanas, so my mind then becomes settled. Then I can accept aging. Because Vedananupassana helps you clear your mind of more unnecessary negativities, defends you. Because you create defensive, how would say, anti-wisdom tendencies. Sometimes you know the reality, but you are not willing to accept it. Okay. Yes. We have 10 more minutes. Okay.
I'm still thinking about Mark's going to the shelter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems to me that the monks who are not arahats are thinking this. I'm going to the shelter. I'm going to get rest and a bed.
Mm.
All delights. It's like they have the idea of self.
Yes.
And they owned the delight. So they take ownership of that delight.
Mm-hmm.
And when that delight doesn't happen, they've lost something they've owned.
Mm.
Whereas the arahats,
mm.
there is no self. They're just taking the body.
Mm-mm.
This body needs rest, and that's only there.
Yes.
So if there's no shelter, they haven't lost anything.
Exactly, yeah.
So I'm thinking, you know, go back to my car.
Mm.
If the car's not there.
Mm.
I'm not thinking about the car.
Mm. Mm.
But the moment I see my car not there.
Not there. Mm.
I have lost something.
Yes.
So what should I do? Should I just...
Mm. Whereas arahants wouldn't get that notion.
I had to let go of myself and I had to let go of the attachment to the car.
That's right, yeah.
Get rid of the car. Go by bus. That's not really. Someone
has
a problem. They're going banana. I go on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
Possessiveness,
yeah.
You might, in a fit of rage, say to someone, you've ruined my life.
Mm.
And in that is this implied, my life.
Yes.
This possessed life. Something that exists to be ruined.
Mm.
And that sounds like that's that same thread, isn't it?
It's me, isn't it?
It's me.
And then everything else is an extension.
See, Venerable Mahakasapa, who would physically resemble the Buddha. Now, he had two students. One student was two samaneras, novice monks. One student, one was an arahat. The other one was typical putujjana. So that he became jealous of the other one. In the absence of the arahant student, his fellow students, and Venerable Mahakasapa, and he set the monastery on fire. Burn it down to the ground. So, and there was a lot of people gathering, and when Venerable Mahakasapa hearing the news, Venerable Mahakasapa and the other arahat student didn't say a word. Whereas the one who set the monastery on fire, he was guilty and he was shivering in fear. And he ran away. He ran away. He ran away from the scene where the Venerable Mahakasapa wouldn't even think about the monastery.
My car.
Yes, good. You know what? It's okay to get a recording. I love to provoke Lux because he always put me on a fascinating direction. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's convenient. You know, it gives me home.
Yes.
Do I really have to get rid of it?
No.
Become enlightened?
No. Like, not at all.
But to get rid of your attitudes to it.
But the fact that I don't want to get rid of it
mm-hmm.
is because I'm attached to it.
Yes.
But it's convenient.
Yeah, so that doesn't matter then. There's no way to compare your enlightenment and still whether to own your car or not.
Yeah, you can use it, but you don't.
Yeah. Attached. See, that's why one of the earliest books by a Western Buddhist that I read was 99 when I moved to America from Sri Lanka by Jack Kornfield. Jack Kornfield used to be a monk for some time. Laundry after ecstasy. Ecstasy implies nirvana. Laundry means to do your day-to-day activities. Mm-hmm. Laundry after ecstasy. That is a masterpiece when it comes to comparing the mindset of an arahat and a worldly person. It's a masterpiece. Laundry after ecstasy. Recently, a wealthy businessman called me from Sri Lanka. He said that he frequents temples and spends a lot of money for charity. And then he has trained his two children for charity as well. Now, one day he asked me recently whether he should become a monk. I told him, that's the wrong question. I don't answer the wrong question. I said, question is wrong. Why, Bhante, you say the question is wrong? Because there's no question like whether I should become a monk. What about your lay life? Okay, I love my children. I want to send my children either to UK or England or America for studies. What about your wife? You're 38, 37 years old. So yes, I have to take care of my business. Sometimes I wonder whether I must ask my wife to take care of all my estates and businesses and take care of my children. So then I wonder whether I should become a monk. I say, no, again the wrong question. This time your question is a little different, but still, there's no I wonder whether I should become a monk. And that's the wrong question. Right now what happens is you pre-own nirvana, you pre-own enlightenment, just like you claim you have acquired a lot of businesses. And that's called avarice of nirvana. Don't have avarice for nirvana. You are extremely greedy. Yeah, greedy, extremely greedy of nirvana. Because that would shake, that would plant some that would take away your mental emotional stability. So that is always better to ask yourself whether because there could be other. There are other easy opportunities for you to practice the Dhamma. So then I suggested him that take a break from his business to go for a 14-day retreat in Anuradhapur area. Then he asked me, well, there's a meditation spa hotel there. I think I have been there. When somebody asked me for a retreat, I refused. Humbly, I refused, but I never wanted to go for spa meditation. It's more like romantic, sugar-coated Buddhist practice. So I never wanted that. However, he said, you are a very romantic person. So there's when it comes to masquerading thought, there's a fine line between spiritual devotion and romance. So that you have to think about that. And then now... He said that he will call me tomorrow. and he will call me tomorrow. I know the kind of answer he's going to give me. And he would say that, okay, I will wait until my children are big and they have done their studies and education. Then definitely, I know one thing he's going to ask. Is Bhante, is okay, both my wife and I go become monks and nuns? I wouldn't be surprised. I know what he's going to say. So that's why he's very, how to say, he's greedy. He won't, okay, Nirvana is mine. I also have the same thing. But the thing is, when I stay longer in my meditation, I would get some headache. That's when I'm not meditating actually. I'm going through another round of my imagination. So then I will stop right away and do deep breath, and I will do the walking instead. So I would do my meditation with my eyes cast down, open eye meditation. So thank you very much. See you next.